Hi there, and welcome to A Different Way of Seeing. Have you ever wondered how a disabled person lives their life? Join our host, Lois Drachen, as she chats to people about work, education, travel, sport, the arts, and leisure, and the tools and techniques they use to live their lives with the disability. And now, on with the show.
Hi there, and welcome to today's episode of A Different Way of Seeing, a podcast where we talk all things impacting on persons with disability. Today, we're chatting to Dr. Michelle Boerter, and rather than me giving a long and detailed explanation of who Michelle is and what she does, let's ask Michelle to do that. Michelle, how are you doing today?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity. It's great to have the time to chat to you today.
Well, I'm really excited to hear a little bit about what we're going to be talking about paradigms and frameworks of thinking around the topic of disability, because that's an area of study for you, I think.
Yes, it is. So, just to give a little background to me, I am Cape Town born and bred, and I have a visual impairment. I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa when I was 2, which is a progressive condition. And over the past 10 years, I've experienced very changing vision that has become increasingly less usable to me. And I think it's really my experience as someone with a disability that sort of drew me into the career that I am now pursuing, which is in the academic space mainly. I was drawn to the field of disability studies as a young undergraduate student. And that was a really, important time in my life where some of the things that we're going to speak about today around the way that disability is viewed, suddenly I was being exposed to that. And I was being able to, I was given access to thinking about theories of disability and thinking about how is disability thought of in the world and how does that make a difference to my life as a person with a disability. So that was a really, important time for me, not just academically, but in my own personal life. So I'm currently a postdoctoral fellow at Stellenbosch University in the Center for Disability and Rehabilitation Studies. My research work is very focused on the area of blindness and visual impairment and rehabilitation, thinking about how people who experience sight loss later in life, how they experience rehabilitation programs, how those programs might shape their sense of self and their identities. I've also had some experience working in the nonprofit space as well, and worked for several years as a job placement officer at a local organization where I assisted youth with visual impairment to enter employment. So in that sense, I often feel like I've got a foot in the academic world, but I still have a foot firmly planted in the more sort of ground level disability world when it comes to the provision of services and the nonprofit sector.
I think that's important because that gives you the academic approach, but it also gives you the real world lived experiences. And I think sometimes if we're talking academia, if we're talking theoretical abstract knowledge, it's very important to have that, the research, the backing, but there's also that very important aspect of how does that play out in the lived experiences of persons with disabilities. So I think that having a foot in both camps and both experiences gives you a very rounded sense of a very much more holistic sense of what the real situation is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's so important, and I hope that that's something we'll do in our conversation today, is really take these ideas that are abstract, you know, that can be quite, that can also feel quite inaccessible, in the sense that they can be sort of shrouded in that sort of academic-y kind of language, and they can feel, you know, oh, it's a lot of effort to kind of wade through all of that. I hope we can take those ideas and actually think about how they have implications for people's real lives and real experiences. And I do think there's so much room for the academic space and the activist space to talk and to find ways to communicate and to kind of sit down together and speak the same language. I think sometimes we miss each other, and that's really problematic. So, yeah, I hope we can speak to that today.
Yeah, I think it's so important to do that. Both approaches, both perspectives are crucially important. And finding a way to all work together to solve the reality of the situations. That sounds so like abstract and up in the air, doesn't it? But it really is. It's one of those situations. There are real life challenges that we face, and there is a wider context in which those occur. So we need to all work together to find solutions and move forward. But rather than talking about that type of thing, maybe we need to take a step back and look at some of the frameworks, some of the paradigms of thinking, talking about disability. So what can you tell us about those? Because I think this is something that can cause so much controversy and so much confusion. And I'd really like for us to try and unpack a little bit about what those main ways of talking, ways of thinking are, and then look at how they play out. So we need to start with the theory.
Sure. So I think first it's important just to sort of say, what do we mean by paradigm? You know, even that in itself is like, you know, a tricky word to you know, think about. What is that? What are we talking about here today? So I think a way to understand that is we're talking about how disability is viewed and how it is approached. And that can mean how it is theorized in you know, academic work, theories of disability, what is disabling. But it also speaks to broader things. How do we teach about disability? How do we train our healthcare providers and our health professionals about disability? What ideas surround that? How do we teach our children in schools about what disability is? And then how are our policies made? What informs our disability legislation? What informs, you know, an employer's view of disability? So there's a lot that, you know, that this speaks to. But where we start, and well, where I'm going to start as I kind of speak to these things, is at a theoretical space. So how has disability been theorized? What ideas have shaped views on disability? So I've picked out three to speak about today and just to share a little bit about. There are more, arguably, but these are some big ideas. And they will be familiar to the initiated, but they might be very new to people who are not involved in the disability sector, both academically or in the activist space or the service provision space. So the first that I want to speak about, and it's often where we start in disability studies, it's often the point of departure for us, is we talk about something called the medical model of disability. Sometimes it's been called the personal tragedy model or the welfare or charity model of disability. Now, this says that disability is a problem of the individual body. That's how disability is understood or theorized within this view. It's a problem of the individual body, and it's a problem that either needs to be cured, fixed, made better, or if it can't be cured, fixed, or made better through medical intervention, then it needs to be either cared for or rehabilitated to a point where we're able to integrate it back into society in some way. And if it can't be integrated back, then it needs to be set aside. So within an institutional context, there is no space then for that body to participate. So the medical model is very much about thinking about the body as a problem. There is a phrase that's used that says, you know, in this view, disability is about bodies that have gone wrong. It's very individual. So it's based on, again, thinking about individual bodies. And it is based on the idea that disabled people require the goodwill of the rest of society. So whether that's informal charity or whether it's saying, you know, if this person is employed, it's because they're being given a chance by an employer. So the idea is that disabled people have bodies that are not functioning optimally, and they need to receive goodwill and welfare.
So what are some of the implications of this way of seeing disability? You know, out in the real world, I can see all sorts of problematic situations that come up if we as disabilities are seen as being broken, as being less than. Is that exactly the kind of thinking that informs that?
Exactly. So we call this the medical model because these ideas have often been attributed to the medical profession. Now, a quick note on that is to say, just because this is called a medical model, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're saying that medicine is bad or medical professionals are bad or health professionals are bad. Not at all. What we are saying is that there are some problematic ideas about people with disabilities that are rooted in traditional approaches in these spheres of medicine, charity, and welfare. And it has massive implications. I mean, we can think about, as I mentioned earlier, what does it mean for a young medical student or health professional student, physio, OT, to be taught about disability in this way, to be sort of given the idea that people with disabilities are sort of inherently needy. and another issue with the medical model is that people with disabilities have no voice within this approach. They are not viewed as the experts in their own lives. So the medical model establishes very clear boundaries between who the experts are, who's allowed to know what people need. And those experts are your medical practitioners or your rehabilitation workers. They get positioned as the experts who know what people with disabilities need, and people with disabilities have no voice in this process. They are not included as stakeholders in their own health or rehabilitation or development. So there are massive implications also for how society in general views people with disabilities. You know,
if a child is growing up taught that a child or a person with a disability is less than, then how do we ever work to be seen as inclusive, productive members of society? If society and if the thinking is that, oh, a person with a disability is incapable, unable, and dependent on others. So there are huge implications in terms of not just the way how society sees us, but also through that, because of pervasiveness of societal thinking, how we see ourselves. And I can see that's highly problematic.
Exactly. And if disability is on me, if that makes sense. So if it's my visual impairment that is the barrier, then there is no responsibility on society to do anything about that, except to treat me with goodwill. So to, you know, be kind to me if they feel like it, basically. There's no society bears no responsibility then for my inclusion, which I think takes us quite nicely on to the second idea that I want to speak about.
Great. Which, let's move on to that one.
So this is an idea that, again, the initiated in the disability sector will be very familiar with. It's the social model, what we call the social model. It's also been called the British social model because it's connected very closely to a political movement of people with disabilities in the UK, which started gaining momentum in the 70s and on into the 1980s. So it has a long history. This is not a new idea. But what I find when I've spoken about this, especially to people who don't have knowledge in the disability sector, this is a sort of transformative idea for people. So what does the social model say? It says that disability is not an individual issue, so it's not the body gone wrong, but it's actually a political issue. So what the social model does as a theory is it draws a very clear distinction between impairment and disability. So it says that impairment is the bodily issue. So my visual impairment is the fact that I cannot see as you know, sighted people do. That's the impairment. But disability is something quite different. The social model says that disability is socially constructed. So disability is imposed on people with impairments by an inaccessible world. So suddenly the whole idea shifts around what disability is and what is disabling. So quite suddenly, it's not my visual impairment that disables me. It is the inaccessible environment. It is the lack of accessible public transport, or the way that a building is designed, or when I'm in a presentation and the presenter doesn't explain the images on the screen, that is disabling. So the idea that's often used is the idea of a barrier, a disabling barrier. These things that have been set up and constructed in society that prevent people from participating. So with the social model, suddenly there is responsibility on society. Society is responsible for disability. Disability becomes an issue of human rights, an issue of discrimination. We have the term disablism, which is akin to racism or sexism. It falls into the same bracket as other social discrimination that prevents people from participating. So you can kind of see the how valuable this certainly was for disabled people and probably continues to be. In my early disability studies life as a 20-something who had never encountered these kinds of ideas, this was huge for me. I mean, this was massive, because suddenly, you know, your ideas about yourself change, and there's an issue of human rights. You know, I was in a conversation with someone actually just this week, also with a visual impairment, and she was talking about starting her university days and saying, "I never knew about human rights, and suddenly I was exposed to this whole discourse about myself, and I realized, oh, I have human rights. Like, I have rights as a person with a disability." The last thing to say about the social model is that it doesn't just talk about physical barriers. So the sort of environmental barriers that people with disabilities face, you know, the inaccessible building, or the inaccessible transport or social spaces. It also talks about attitudinal barriers. So barriers in people's attitudes towards disability. So it makes a little link between negative attitudes and inaccessible and disabling barriers. And that's quite key. And we'll talk about that a bit more, I think, as we move on.
I can almost see that as the medical model evolved into the social model, the same happened in terms of attitudes and perceptions towards disability, in terms of people's attitudes. Because for me, just as previously, if we were believed to be broken and needing of help, in terms of the social model, suddenly we're seen as the attitudes and the problems that come up are around the way that others, it's around the focus of where the barriers lie. That once there's
exactly
us as individuals, as persons with disabilities, and then instead of that, the social model is now saying there is an element in which the environment and the context is the barrier that is causing a problem.
Exactly, and that changes the landscape. So there's a great quote from a disability studies scholar, very well known, Tom Shakespeare from the UK. And he has a great book called Disability Rights and Wrongs, where he unpacks a lot of these paradigms. And he says of the social model that, and I'm paraphrasing here, but suddenly persons with disabilities didn't have to feel sorry for themselves. They could be angry. And that speaks to the massive political movement that happened. And I don't think in South Africa we have seen this happen. But in the UK, there was a massive sort of uprising, you know, for want of a better word, of disabled activists, and changes happened. There were changes towards, you know, independent living rather than residential, you know, institutionalized care. There was a growth in direct payment systems where people with disabilities were getting direct payments from the government, where they could sort of manage their own services and their own care, you know, out of their own funds that they were receiving. So there were massive changes. And in South Africa, the social model, you know, it informs a lot of our policy because our policies are linked, you know, our disability legislation is connected to the UNCRPD, which is informed by this view. But we haven't seen that same level of sort of large-scale, massive political mobilization of disabled people. And I'm not sure we can quite imagine what that moment must have been like, where disabled people were actually coming together and organizing and mobilizing around this idea that actually society needs to take responsibility for how we are blocked from participating. The third idea that I want to speak about is a broad one, and I'm going to use the phrase critical disability theory or critical disability studies. And this includes a number of different approaches and a number of, you know, in terms of the academic space, a number of different scholars with different interests. So to make it simple, the social model, as we've said, it's thought of, it's often called the big idea in disability. But in the 90s and early 2000s and moving forward, there were several scholars from different academic disciplines with an interest in disability who kind of said, okay, this is great. I mean, the social model, it's huge. It's got so much
value. But is that all? You know, have we solved disability inequality? You know, is the problem of disability now solved by the social model and we can all just move on? And they say, well, no, we think there's more to talk about here. There's more than socially constructed barriers, and there's more to disability experience. So critical disability studies includes people, for example, who are interested in language and representation, who look at literature and say, how is disability represented and what does that do? It includes a large number of feminist disability scholars who say, okay, what about, you know, care? What about women's roles in the disability space? What about, you know, looking at different, different intersections of identity with disability? You know, I'm disabled, but I am a woman. I am disabled, but, so looking at that complex landscape, there are scholars from psychology who say, well, what about, we're talking about the physical impact of encountering a disabling barrier, but what does that do internally? What's happening at the sort of psychological and emotional level in the lives of disabled people who are excluded, who are facing daily exclusion? Another thing that is often argued in critical disability theory is that what underpins the barriers? So the social model identifies that barriers to participation are socially made, they're socially constructed. But the question is, why?
Yeah.
What makes them so powerful? What strengthens, what makes disablism so pervasive and persistent? We can look at our own legislation, for example, in South Africa, as I said, influenced quite heavily by the United Nations Convention, and that idea of socially, made barriers. And our legislation, looks pretty nifty. But why does exclusion persist? If there wasn't something more going on, then society recognizing, we're actually producing the disabling conditions, that's a bad thing. Then those things would change, surely. So what this sort of approach or view does is it takes us deeper and it kind of forces us to ask deeper questions. And that can be really uncomfortable because it is tempting to kind of go, oh, well, we saw the medical model, that wasn't great. And then we saw the social model and that was really exciting. And we were really excited about that. But now you're telling me it's not, there's more.
We're not done.
So yeah. We're not done. Exactly. So it can take us into quite a tricky space. There's a lot of internal debate in disability studies around, whether these approaches are appropriate, whether it's a good thing to talk about emotional and psychological struggles, or whether that actually just takes us right back to the medical model. So there's a lot of there's a lot of discussion and sometimes quite heated debate in this space about whether we should be taking these things further. My personal view is that it's actually crucial to get a full understanding of what people with disabilities are experiencing in the world. And for me as a person with a disability to actually fully understand myself and my own experience and my own feelings, there is a need to think about more than physical barriers. So just to mention another really helpful piece of work, well, something that I found really helpful, there is a disability studies and feminist writer called Rosemary Garland Thompson, who has a very helpful idea in disability, and she calls it misfitting. And when she talks about misfitting, she's talking about an experience that all of us as people with disabilities can relate to. You know, moving through the world and you're going along and it's all fine, and then suddenly encountering something that makes you go, "Ooh, I don't fit. This is uncomfortable. I've encountered a barrier." And that barrier could be physical, it could be attitudinal. And it's not to say that you're misfitting all the time.
Yeah.
You move in and out of fitting and misfitting. And in fact, her argument, which is really helpful, is that everyone does, not just people with disabilities. We are all fitting and misfitting. I think the example she uses is the woman standing up in the boardroom, you know, and the barriers she might encounter there. You know, that is a misfit. She may not have a disability. And that encompasses, you know, as I said, not just the physical barriers, but representations, you know, encountering a representation of yourself as something negative. You know, I don't know, you know, if you've had the experience of sitting around a dinner table, having a lovely time, and suddenly someone says something around blindness or disability, or shares a joke that just doesn't land or is inappropriate, and suddenly you feel, oh, there's something's shifted here. And that's what she would describe as a misfit, which I think is a really helpful idea.
Yes, it's an interesting one to think about. And I would definitely agree with you that we're not alone in shifting between fitting and misfitting as persons with disabilities. I think it's something that does happen in almost any area of life, any area of identity. But it's a very useful lens through which to perceive connection and disconnection, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I'm still left with the sense that identifying the problems is one thing, but actually removing them, shifting beyond them.
Yeah.
That's almost where I see the greatest problem coming in. Because no matter how you look at disability, our realities are such that we do experience barriers, be they real physical barriers or attitudinal barriers. So how do we actually bring that down into leveling playing field, becoming more inclusive?
No, exactly. And that's, I think that's the importance of this critical disability view that says, you know, something else is going on. Something else is happening here that is giving disabled discrimination potency. So, I mean, I think there's several things. Firstly, I think there is a need to engage as people with disabilities and with people with disabilities around these issues. I think so many people, and I think of my younger self again, have no understanding of, you know, how they are viewed in society and why that's problematic. And on one level, you know, why should we? Because we're actually all just trying to, you know, survive. But there's a real need for that level of understanding. Of, you know, this is why I experience discrimination, and it's not okay. And being able to, you know, engage with each other on those issues, I think builds a sort of a sense of community identity or, you know, collective consciousness. I know that sounds a bit wifty-wafty, around how we're socially positioned and then being able to, yeah, I guess to advocate for ourselves as well. And I think there's a great need for education.
It's, you know, because I can see this in so many different ways. I can see partial solutions and partial, I suppose, responsibility. But ultimately, and we agreed to part of this conversation, that to a degree, without that sense of unified action as a community, we lack a single voice or the power of our unified voices to start creating shifts. Because there's certain work that could be done at systems level, at governmental level, and maybe very probably is being done. But then there's also implementation into society. There's societal perceptions. And each of those probably needs to be tackled in a slightly different way to really start making our world totally inclusive. It is an incredibly complex problem and a really challenging approach.
Yeah, and I think when we come down to, you know, thinking about the very deep-seated way that disabled discrimination is actually rooted in the minds of non-disabled people in a psychological way, you know, then we really get to the point of going, wow, how do we address that? And I think there is so much need for education and for opportunities for our children to engage across disability, to engage with diversity. Because I think at that stage, there is so much opportunity to grow empathy, to grow understanding, and we miss this opportunity all the time. You know, currently in our, I've recently had an opportunity to have a look at life skills curriculum in South Africa and, you know, how disability is represented there and if it's represented there. And it really isn't. There's nothing explicit about disability in our curriculum. And if it's left, you know, if it's to the teacher's discretion, you know, one must wonder what is going to be taught. You know, you might have someone who can really engage with disability in this way, but you are more likely to have kids being taught in that sort of welfare model way. You know, you must be good to people with disabilities. Don't stare at them. Be nice to them. Donate to organizations. You know, that's good citizenship or whatever.
But that also comes out in other ways socially. If you think of books that were written or the way disability was portrayed in books written in the 19th century, 18th century.
Mm. Yes.
And that was probably at a time where the medical model did determine much of the approach to disability. Where now we're still seeing that because people read those books and are impacted on, they're affected, their thinking is affected by the way the very few characters with disabilities that are represented in literature, the way they are represented. And it's interesting to see that in terms of literature of and movies, TV, magazines, how much that impacts on people's thinking. People who haven't got a personal knowledge or contact with disability. As I said, I keep coming back to it's an incredibly complicated, complex situation that it's going to take a long time, sadly, I think, to really address and move beyond totally. But I do believe that it's doable.
Yeah, and it's generational as well. You know, I think there are ideas that are, you know, passed down from generation to generation. And disability ideas, that is one set of ideas, and not just within families,
but also if we look at, again, training of medical professionals, you know, what ideas are being passed down from the older generation of teachers? And I guess, how do we, and once again, I think it comes down to education and, you know, injecting this kind of disability studies critical perspective into training modules, which is a work in progress. But, you know, if that doesn't happen, then those ideas will just get, you know, recycled and passed on. And you know, there is that generational idea. And I mean, in my own life, I find the people who I grew up with have a far superior sort of disability sense, and it's very intuitive. You know, they weren't taught anything, you know, but they have this very intuitive disability understanding. And it's simply from interacting with me over the years. So I think there's much to be said about making sure that there's spaces like that where people can, you know, interact. And I mean, thinking about what you were just saying about, you know, representations, we also need to say, what does it do to a person with a disability when we see ourselves mirrored like that?
Yes.
Because it is a mirror. We are, you know, we're seeing ourselves reflected. What does that do to our sense of self? What do we internalize when we see images? And it might not even be, you know, they might not always be negative images. What do I do as someone who might be struggling in my disability identity or in my life with disability in some way, you know, seeing the sort of requirement for the sort of triumphant, overcoming disabled figure. I often say, you know, disability is represented in two ways. Either it's the overcoming, triumphant, you know, brilliant person who's climbed a mountain or done something amazing, or it's the sad, unfortunate, you know, figure of charity, or, you know, there's very seldom middle ground. There's very seldom, exactly, like, we're all just doing our best. Yes. And some days are great and some days are really not great. So where is the mirror for me of just a person doing their life and having, you know, struggles and triumphs and sadness and happiness and, you know, the whole spectrum of emotions? I think that's quite a problem in our world.
And I think maybe that's, again, a topic that I need to take note of for another episode of the podcast, is, you know, that kind of mirror. And again, digression. Note it down, move on. But Michelle, I want to ask you, how do we then, as people living in a world that the expectations of others can differ widely, whether it's informed by the medical model, the social model, the critical disability thing, you know, whichever model that it's coming from, how do we, as a person, an individual with a disability, how do we navigate that world ourselves?
I think for me, and this is really tricky, we need to have great empathy for those around us. And that can be really hard. When, you know, it's something I've been practicing or trying to practice recently, because I think when I was younger, I was very quick to become conflictual and aggressive. And, you know, I was a young student and, you know, rah, 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 you know, in that headspace. But, you know, when I encounter, for example, someone in maybe the rehabilitation profession who
you know, has a view of disability that feels problematic to me, my first response, or what I hope and try to be my first response, is empathy. Because how can people know better if they have not been taught? And that's a really tricky space. As I say, it's hard to do, but I think the understanding that, you know, people are raised in these ideas, whether it's through their schooling or the things they've seen on, you know, in the media or their training or whatever it is. So I think there's a great need for empathy. I think there's a great need for difficult conversations with, you know, whether those are informal or more professional. And I think, yeah, as persons with disabilities, to navigate this space, I also think we need to be, we also need to hold empathy for ourselves as well, because we're not always going to be great at this. You know, I think there's a careful balance between, you know, I guess the caveat I want to put on that is by saying, you know, we need to hold empathy for other people. You know, that's without saying we just need to go, oh, well, what more can we expect? I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that there needs to be room for, you know, for activism and for a human rights approach to disability, absolutely, 100%. But I think we also need to, understand where these things come from, and that they are often happening very unconsciously they may not always be unconscious, but for the people in our lives, some of the things that we encounter are very unconscious. You know, when someone says to me, I don't really see you as blind, that for me is actually quite an uncomfortable thing to hear, because I feel like I've fought very hard to be a blind person and to, you know, build this positive blind identity. So when you say to me, I don't see you as blind, then I actually bristle, but I've got to, you know, I could snap, but it's more helpful for me to say, to actually understand where that's coming from and when it's appropriate to have a conversation about that.
That topic of, ought we to be advocates 24 hours a day, is a very, very tough one, because we should be allowed to just be people, because we are just people. But living in a world where often we are seen as different or other or marginalized, or it is. I think I've said this probably 100 times, no, not quite 100, but it's such a complex situation. And I suppose we have to deal with each situation as it comes up and navigate it as best we can. And I like the fact that, yes, we need to be empathetic to the fact that people don't understand our situation as well as we do, or sometimes at all. But they're also trying to navigate a situation that is complicated for them. So I do like the focus on empathy. And yes, there are times that it's hard. So also that empathy on ourselves. So I like that approach. Thank you for sharing that, Michelle. I want to end off the chat today with a very quick 3-2-1, which is something that I want to make as a standard part of the podcast. So we're going to be asking you 3 questions and just quick answers to those. Mm-hmm. So, before we get to the 3-2-1, because I think this is also important, Michelle, if people would like to find out more about you, if they'd like to chat to you about the work that you're doing or about looking at resolving some of the challenges that are being faced, how can people reach you?
Sure. So I am quite social media averse, but you can find me on my LinkedIn profile, and you're welcome to contact me that way. there are about a gazillion Michelle Boertes on the internet. It's a very popular name, apparently. So if you do a search, you might want to just pop Stellenbosch University or postdoctoral research fellow in that search, and I should pop up. And yeah, that's probably the best way to get in touch. You can also search for some of my published work on Google Scholar. Again, Michelle Boertes and blindness or disability will probably do the trick there. Yeah, so those would be the ways to see some of my work or to get in touch.
I really loved that, because you realize that you're working with an academic, someone who's used to finding the challenges of searching for things and knowing the terms that are necessary to make certain that you arrive at the correct information. So that's a lovely way of putting it. Thank you, Michelle.
In the interview, you probably heard me mentioning the 3-2-1 that I did with Michelle. I thought about releasing it with the podcast, but I thought it would make this episode a little bit too long. So what I decided to do is release that as bonus content. You'll hear more about how to access the bonus content within the next month or so. So keep listening to the podcast for more details, or you can hop on to my Facebook page, which is Lois Strachan Speaker, or Lois Strachan, A Different Way of Seeing, and you'll be amongst the first to know about that bonus content. Thanks so much for listening. And if you haven't already done so, we would love for you to subscribe to the podcast and to rate and review us on iTunes, because that'll really help us to reach more listeners. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to A Different Way of Seeing. We'd love to connect with you. So find Lois at loisstrachan.com or Facebook, Lois Strachan Speaker. This podcast was edited by Craig Strachan using Hindenburg Pro. Hindenburg, it's all about the story. The credits are done at Naledi Media. Naledi Media, all your vocal needs under one roof. Read by Charlie Yazzie. That's it for now. Thank you for joining us, and see you next time when we bring you into the world of seeing differently.